I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ruler is the world's finest magazine of cycling and cycling culture. Established in 2006, Ruler interviews the world's biggest cycling names and covers the world's biggest cycling races. Visit our website at ruler.cc and subscribe to support our in-depth features, long reads, independent journalism, stunning photography and immersive cycling coverage. I'm Edward Pickering, I'm the editor of Ruler, and this is Ruler Conversations. I'm Edward Pickering, I'm the editor of Ruler, and this is Ruler Conversations. It's an exciting week for us at Ruler Towers because the new edition of the magazine, number 126, the Classics edition, is out now. It's a deep dive into the culture and meaning of the world's biggest and best one-day races, and it answers important questions such as, which World Tour director sportif and former Gent-Wevelgem winner also has a side hustle in painting expressionistic landscapes, which major R&B artist is also a keen cyclist, and why is the Ronde van Vlaanderen just like Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven? Joining me today is James Start, Ruler's roving photojournalist. James, Tour of Flanders, Stairway to Heaven. Have you got any better comparisons than that?
Well, I was sitting in the car with Scott Sunderland when we were going through some of these Flemish roads, and he was telling me that I guess The Clash comes to my head, but I didn't have actually a certain song that jumped out at me. So I was thinking maybe Rocks Off by the Rolling Stones. I mean, obviously the cobbles and rocks go together. And then there's this great, really punchy hook, like the climbs of Flanders. And then the verse is, you know, is a little more, just a little flatter, just kind of like the roads in between, I guess.
I was worried you're going to start singing there, James. I was thinking Beach Boys, Help Me Rhonda, my best effort. So before we get onto the mag, just quickly, did you watch the racing over the last week? We had Volta Catalunya and several classics going on.
Yeah, I mean, it was like exploit after exploit, I think. Not to mention a mischievous pit stop by Pogacar at some point down in Catalunya. But, you know, it was big names doing big rides all week long.
Yeah, like Pogacar won 4 out of the 7 stages in Catalunya, a narrow second in another of the stages. Formidable achievements. There was nobody else in the GC so dominant. And it seems like the most interesting thing cycling fans and cycling pundits got to talk about is whether this is interesting or not. I just want to get your perspective. Are you finding Pogacar's dominance boring, or are you enjoying it?
I have to say I'm on the enjoyment side of it. Why? Because he does it with such flair. He's having so much fun out there. And okay, so he's riding rings around the guys, but you know, he makes use of that talent to tell stories and to celebrate the sport and to celebrate, you know, greatness. And he could be sometimes playful. He goes on the attack, stops to for a pit stop, hides, jumps back into the pack, and comes back to the guys. I mean, that's like Bahamontes, like sitting up on top of a climb eating an ice cream or something. Those are the sorts of things that we'll talk about, I think, beyond the amazing exploits that he was just popping out on a daily basis. I don't mind dominance when it's used creatively like that. I tend to be a fan of it.
I tend to agree. I think it's just the fact that he does attack from a long way out. I mean, he's turned the interesting part of the race from the end of it to the middle of it. Although he is superior in a lot of the races he does, he still takes a certain amount of risk. And I kind of like it. It's kind of, you know, maybe we'll look back on his career as good as Merckx, but funnier. And maybe that's the way we're going to look at it. In the classics, we'll go into all of them just a brief couple of headlines. In women's game, Bevergam, Lorena Weber's won in a sprint. Men's version, Mads Pedersen won. And E3 place, I was going to call him Adrie van der Poel. Mathieu van der Poel was the winner quite dominantly. What was your takeaway from the long weekend other than van der Poel won one race and didn't win the next?
More great racing. I mean, just all around. You know, the domination of van der Poel with the big solo in E3 and then the power of numbers with Trek on Sunday. And, you know, that's generally, so often that comes down to a sprint, the Gent Wevelgem. And they just blew the race apart. They were all over the road all day long. And, you know, at the end, the pack did come close to making it a sprint, but you got two guys like Pedersen and van der Poel up the road. They're not going to sit up for and let that sprint happen. I mean, it was amazing.
A couple of things about that. I mean, van der Poel was, in a way, he's become the lightning rod, the focal point around the classics, you know, for obvious reasons. And it was interesting to see because after he won E3, there were a lot of instant hot takes that he's dominant and no one can compete with him, mainly because when Wout van Aert chased him, he was unable to close the gap. And this was seen as a great moment of psychological domination. But thing is, like, you've got to take into account the fact that van Aert almost caught him after having crashed absolutely the worst possible moment anybody could crash, which is right near the bottom of the Paterberg. And just getting back on, getting moving again, moving through the field and chasing, that's the race-winning effort right there. And the fact that he had to make that effort in order to even get close to van der Poel means that, you know, he's obviously physically pretty good, actually, and van der Poel might not have things his own way. On the other hand, van der Poel is building a palmares in the classics, which is just becoming incredible. I mean, he's not quite yet the most successful Tour of Flanders there's ever been, but he's not far off. He's two wins, I think, and two second places and a fourth. To my mind, the best palmares ever in the Tour of Flanders is Johan Museeuw, who won three times, second three times and third a couple of times. Depending on what happens this Sunday, van der Poel could be starting to get up towards equaling Museeuw, maybe even looking at overtaking. Is he the best ever? Is he the best right now? Is he being made to look good by a bit of bad luck from other riders? What do you think about that?
Bike racing is like this, and the classics especially. Every year, there's a new superhero, it seems like. Last year, it was, for a lot of last year it was Jumbo Visma. I mean, they went 1-2 at Gent Wevelgem, and they neither van Aert or the defending champion Christophe Laporte was even there. Part of it's that van der Poel is not afraid to attack. He can make those big solo moves. He's got the rainbow stripes on his back, which makes him just look bigger than life. The thing that sets van der Poel apart right now is his ability to consistently pick and peak for the biggest races. Van Aert is tremendous in his versatility. He can do time trials and he can climb pretty well, actually. But when it comes to the big, big wins, being there on the day where it counts, van der Poel has got that down. And he's not being distracted. He's like, this is my thing. This is my game. I'm a classics rider. I'm going to win all the biggest one-day races. So it's exciting to see. But, as we've seen in the past, and as we've seen just yesterday, you can't take anything for granted, even when your name is Mathieu van der Poel.
He has been out-sprinted at the end of long classics. Pedersen did it yesterday.
At Flanders.
And Asgreen did it to him in the Tour of Flanders. So, and we will actually get on to Wout van Aert later in this podcast. So let's actually move on to the magazine, Rouleau 126 Classics. Just a quick reminder that Rouleau Conversations listeners can get a discount on subscribing to Rouleau by going to rouleau.cc/subscribe and entering the code podcast15. Please, please subscribe. It's a beautiful magazine. We're doing our best to make long-lasting, immersive coverage of cycling, taking special care over the words, the pictures, the layout and the editing process. Proper journalism does not come cheap, but each magazine we make is a physical and ongoing record of where the sport and its culture are at. So please support us to keep on doing more of the good stuff. The best way you can do that is by subscribing. So, the cover of Rouleau 126. Nice photograph, James.
Yeah, I just love the landscape of northern France where Roubaix happens. It's a picture of a sign on the road one way pointing towards Roubaix, one way pointing towards Paris. And it's just on this red brick house that's, I believe, if memory serves me, it's either in Trois-Villes where the first cobble sections start, or it's in the middle of the Trois-Villes section. And it has a picture of Jean Stablinski, who was, you know, one of the local heroes, a French cyclist, world champion, I believe. And he actually worked in the mines, I believe. So, you know, he's like the number one son of this race. And there's a picture of him and then the sign that says Roubaix, Paris. And it just sort of sums up that landscape up there, I think, and the buildings and the spirit of the race.
Yeah, you can see the accumulated dirt of years kind of ground into the brickwork there. And I love this photograph. It had been a few issues since we'd had a photograph, so we were keen on having a photographic cover for 126. We considered a few. There was a lovely shot of Wout van Aert, who we've interviewed in this magazine, by Christophe Ramon, which we really liked. It's a great portrait. But we kept on gravitating back to this one. I loved it just for the structure of the photograph. It's very, very horizontal, very much layers going up from the bottom of the photograph to the top. Very, very straight lines, apart from the beautiful curve of the rainbows on the photograph of Stablinski. And the thing I loved about it most was the fact that it's Roubaix-Paris. Like, the race is Paris-Roubaix. And I just thought it was quite playful to have that, but loved it. And I felt it, you know, the weather, the kind of time of year, the muted colours of that part of the world very much come through in this photograph.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, I've photographed northern France, the roads of Roubaix and stuff many times. And I've also spent a lot of time photographing Flanders, which I love also. But the thing about this corner of France is it's just everything. Every building is so weathered and worn. All these buildings are still being lived in by the families and farmers that probably worked the land for generations, it seems like to me. There's just a grit in this landscape that you don't always find in Flanders. Many corners of Flanders is pretty wealthy. I mean, the Quermont, the little village on the old Quermont, it's almost a tourist stop for Sunday travelers and stuff. And the buildings are kept up much better than the ones you see here on the French landscape. And there's an authenticity to the Roubaix landscape that's just undeniable.
That part of northern France is industrial. Flanders, less industrial than the other half of Belgium. So that really comes through. First feature in the magazine, exclusive interview and shoot with Wout van Aert, James, and this one was by you. You went to see him and speak to him. What were your impressions of him? What's he like?
He's one of those guys that, you know, everybody wants a piece of him, and it's hard to get any time with him. But you know, we were able to get some significant time with him up at the training camp in around Alicante in January, and you know, he was really cool and just really relaxed. I loved it. He came in almost apologetically. He didn't have time to put on his official team t-shirt or anything like that. And he was like, is that okay? And I was like, that's more than okay. I just want to get a sense of who you are and just, you know, hanging out, you know, and one of the biggest riders in the world just hanging out in jeans and a t-shirt. It was tremendous in terms of the pictures and just in terms of what it said, I think, about him as being just pretty natural guy. And then, you know, and that was confirmed in the interview. I said, well, you're one of the biggest names in the sport. You could live in Monaco or Andorra or anything like that. And, you know, he still lives in Belgium. And he's like, well, you know, I could go down there and there'd be bigger climbs and stuff, but I wouldn't have as many good cyclocross paths. And, you know, I got my family here and my parents here and, you know, a support team for my wife and all. And it just makes a lot more sense for me to stay in Belgium. And I like that a lot. He's obviously one of the biggest names. What I love about all these guys, Pogacar and Van der Poel and Van Aert, is just they obviously just love to race. And they do it differently. And Van Aert's thing is he's really proud of his versatility and consistency throughout the year. And the fact that, like he said, one of his greatest moments was the year when he won a climbing stage in the Tour, Mont Ventoux, the time trial stage in the Tour, and then I think it was the Champs-Élysées as well, the sprint stage. And he was just like, I'm really proud of that kind of versatility. I asked him, how does he deal with losing? This is a theme I've been asking some of the riders. Roglic gave me a great quote in the previous issue about he said to me, you know, every loss is one step closer to winning. And Van Aert came up with a completely different answer. He just looked at me and said, well, I learned to lose very early because I grew up racing against Mathieu van der Poel. And when you grew up racing against Mathieu, you know that no win is a given. And you're going to lose as many times as you're going to win. So, you know, he says, as a result, when I do win, I really savor it. I really understand it. But I understand that it's not given, and you're going to have to lose a lot in this game. And I just thought that was a very poignant, insightful quote. Before we leave, though, the one other thing about Wood that really impressed me was I talked to him about, you know, his decision to leave the tour last year to be with his wife while she gave birth. And that was for a big name rider like Wood, that was a big decision. And he just said to me flatly, well, I'm surprised that anybody would even consider doing something else. I mean, bike racing is bike racing. It's great. It's my job. It's my passion. But it takes a back seat to family and children. And I think that said a lot about who he was or who he is. So, yeah, I mean, just a whole lot of things out of that interview I thought were really poignant and gave me insight to a little bit more of what drives Woot and what he's about. And I came away really impressed.
The next feature is called How to Win Paris-Roubaix Femme. And we thought for this one we'd ask the actual experts, who are Lizzie Deignan, Elisa Longo Borghini, and Alison Jackson, who are the three winners of the race so far. And rather than listen to us two speculating and pontificating about how to win Paris-Roubaix Femme, let's play some clips from each of the interviews we did. Just apologies for any background noise in the interviews. We recorded these at Rouleau Live at the end of last year, and Rouleau readers do like to talk loudly in the background about cycling.
The team meeting, you know, beforehand we had probably the longest team meeting we've ever had, discussing each cobbled sector, and all I was concerned about was knowing that the first cobbled sector was 8 kilometers. That's the only thing, piece of information that I kept in my mind, because I knew the rest was irrelevant, and then I really just focused on that being the most important part. And from there, have to be reactive rather than, I mean, you can't even look at your stem. No point trying to read something that's written on your stem. You really have to be able to follow your instincts. And yeah, obviously having experience allows you to trust your instincts. I was roommate with Ellen Van Dijk, and she was incredibly nervous, and I just felt incredibly relaxed in comparison. So yeah, I was fortunate not to have any pressure on my shoulders. I had actually had a conversation with Trek the night before about renewing my contract. So I felt I think that actually had quite an impact on my ride the next day, because I felt valued and supported and, you know, pretty safe in my situation going forward. There was a point in the race, like early on, I got a gap quite quickly of over a minute, but the team car didn't come up to me because at that point I was still the leader. You know, they were staying with Ellen and Elisa, and I said over the radio, what do you want me to do? And they sort of said, you know, push it, but hold something back. And then the gap just kept going up and up and up. And at some point I said, but I actually said back in the radio, am I still just holding back or am I pushing? And they were like, no, go, go, go. So, well, you probably should have mentioned that earlier.
When did you think you were going to win, barring accidents?
You have like the long straight after the cobbles, like your final cobbles, and then you turn right down into the town. And it was probably when I finally was able to turn right and look back down the road, and I couldn't see Voss or a team car or anybody. And I thought, oh, okay, yeah, this is mine for the taking now.
What's your perspective on it?
Yeah, that it was one of the biggest results of my career, like a turning point in my career, I would say.
I think you need to be able to ride your bike, to guide your bike very well. Normally you need to be like a powerful rider to ride over the cobbles, and you need also to have a lot of luck on your side, because you can be the strongest of the peloton, but a puncture or a small crash can put you out of the game. We were like the strongest team, and we had teammates in the back that could back it up for us. It was this way for Lizzie, and the same was for me, because I had Lucinda and Ellen, and the people were controlling them, because they knew that if they would have caught me, Ellen or Lucinda would have attacked. So this has been like the key moment, or like the secret to win Paris-Roubaix for me. For me, it was a case of improvising. Yeah, I just felt the moment and I just went for my own chance, knowing that I was just doing the right thing for the team. And if I would have been caught, I had other two cards to play with my teammates. You have to embrace the chaos. Yeah, you have to know that everything you are planning probably will just fall apart, and you have to have a plan A, a plan B, a plan C, and then you just need to improvise. That's what I was doing. Yeah, I felt like it was time to go, and I just knew from the moment I went that I would have won. I don't know, sometimes you just feel.
I think you need to be able to have a really high, just like normalized power. You're going to hold a high normalized power all day. The way that I wanted was not being able to, or you didn't have to have the real intense 5 or 10 minute, whereas usually in Paris-Roubaix, when you make an attack, it's going to be that 10 minute of really, really full. For us, it was this just steady, high, normalized pace all day. In the peloton, you'll be able to sit in for a while, save more energy, but then when it's time to go, you have to really go. Whereas in the breakaway, you're riding basically at that always just comfortable pace. With our group, I just wanted to get to the finish with as few people as possible. And if you can do
but,
that solo,
but
great.
From the group, right? Not from the peloton.
Well, yeah, I mean, from at first, yeah, from the peloton, basically that's how, I mean, it's going to be an attritional race, so you want to be as few people as possible. And then even in that group, like, I know that I have a good sprint, so I back myself up in kind of a bunch like that. But even it's the fewer numbers that you have in the group, it's just better odds. I have a few friends that were also in that group, and some that I've been teammates with, that we could basically just kind of talk about, like, I knew that we would both want this breakaway to stay, so just, you know, having a few chats, just how we're going to manage some of the people not riding and so on. But I was going to take a turn every time, because I think you have to lead by example. If everyone thinks I'm the strongest rider in there, I have to show that I'm willing to level the playing field, basically. So tire myself out more, that we're equal and everyone could have a shot at the end. But also just to show that we believed in this break. So I didn't talk to too many people, just a couple. I was very confident in my legs that day, and the gamble was worth it, or the risk was worth it. I think there was a lot of other girls who weren't as strong and also played their cards well to you know, sit on, and if it gets caught, well, or, you know, hope that enough people work that maybe you can make it to the end. But I think, like, yeah, I mean, I want to race boldly, and I think that a lot of times, a bike race favors the bold. I remember hearing it in the radio, looking back and seeing how close they were. But then this was 5K to go, but I think this is what I love about bike racing, that the tactics that play into it. So now, I mean, the group behind, they also just think, oh, we're going to catch them. So they've been going faster than us to be able to catch us. But then at that point, they start kind of playing games, because now, you know, now they're thinking about the final. They're not really thinking even about catching the break. They're thinking about winning the race. Whereas us in the group, then I saw that and I was like straight to the front, like, no way. We've been out here for 140K to give it up in the last five. So now we speed up. So they're playing games, slowing down. We speed up. I get the other girls working and we're flying now. So then, because they're looking at each other and it's so close to the finish, the tactic changes between each group, and then we get that, you know, back up to 20 seconds again. And then, you know, the cohesion in that group just wasn't well, and there wasn't teammates to just lay it out on the line for someone else. And the rest of us individuals in the front thought this was the best shot that we've got and to go all in. And, you know, in that, for me, I would rather ride the whole last 5K on the front all by myself. And then, you know, for that group, pull all seven girls there. And I still thought that I would get at least fifth. And that to me was going to be the best result that I would ever get at, you know, when you have the opportunity to go for a win at Paris-Roubaix, you have to take it, because all the other years, you know, crashes, mechanicals, there's so much that you can't control. And so when you're in the position, I would rather, race in that aggressive boldness than waiting and playing that weight tactic game, because that was the goal that, I mean, when you're in a breakaway, that's what you got to, you're going to have to work to get it there. So when I saw that, no, it wasn't, I mean, you maybe think like we're almost being caught, but I also just believe that we could change that, that our choices could override what was ever, what was happening, and we could, yeah, see what's possible. And you can dig deep, you know, and that's what we train for. We're not training for easy, we're training for hard. We're training for when we have all that fatigue in us that we can still go. And so you just gotta rely on that, the training and the instinct. But in that velodrome, you know, in the end, it's going to be the strongest that wins it. And I just wanted to make sure I've cleared space to just to give my best in the sprint. And I think all of us in that group just didn't want the SD Works rider to win. They'd been winning every race, and she had just been sitting on all day, and probably that would have been the freshest out of all of us. Also, when the crash happened, it was right beside me, but it's in such a split, you know, second moment. She, yeah, luckily didn't touch me at all or take me down, and then we just, yeah, all in for the sprint. But when we come into that velodrome, I just, that's when you're, you just have to go by feeling. On my handlebars, my stem notes that day was, don't think, just do. And when you're a professional and you've been doing this for a lot of years and have the experience, you really just have to trust your instincts. And that's what it was for me in the velodrome.
How does it feel to be a Paris-Roubaix winner?
My goal has always been to win a big monument. And I've always wanted to be in the history books or Canadian legend. And to be able to be the first male or female Canadian to win any monument, let alone Paris-Roubaix, is such a big deal for, and so inspirational for all the other Canadians to see that it's not just a dream, that it's possible. Like one of their peers won this race when it's, cycling is so Eurocentric, but actually one of us from the grassroots, from old farm town in Canada, so far away from where this race is, to actually do it. I just love what it's doing for Canadians in cycling. And then even beyond it, I think like as a personal goal, it's so satisfying. But I think what's so cool is that it's more than just me. So this win is also for Canadians, but it's also for women. And also that it was such an exciting, dramatic race. It really just pushed women's cycling up. And I love that. I mean, this race means so much to all the fans. Like, they love the mud and the chaos and the crashing and the mechanics, all the drama that's involved. And I love it when people come up and tell me, like, where they were when they were watching it, what it felt like, you know, like, who they were with, what they were eating, all that. It's such a win that is shared amongst many people, which is very cool about the sport.
So that was Lizzie Deignan, Elisa Longo-Borghini and Alison Jackson. And maybe we'll, after the next Paris-Roubaix Femme in a couple of weeks' time, we can ask the next winner how to win it, so we can build an archive of instruction manuals for future aspirants to the title. The next feature is a really cool one, actually. It's I love learning about bike racing in Flanders and the culture and colour and the stories behind it. And you went over to Belgium to speak to Scott Sunderland, a former professional racer and now the race director of Flanders Classics. What were you talking to Scott Sunderland about?
Well, yeah, I've known Scott for years since he was a pro himself and then as a DS and all these things, and we're friends. And a couple of years ago, he took over as sort of general director to the Flanders Classics, working directly with the race director of each one of the races, and sort of as the overarching manager and director. And he said to me, one of the things he's focused on is telling individual stories between each different race. We've seen it, say, with the way that the organizers at Gent-Wevelgem have fleshed out and the Flanders Field and the homage to World War One and all the victims there. But all the races have a backstory that he's trying to tell. The one that intrigued me was one of the races we know the least, Skeldeprijs, because it's on this big waterway, actually. You know, I said, so, you know, we're trying to celebrate that. And we go on this tunnel that goes underneath it, and we ride up one side and then cross back over and And I was like, I never thought of a race director as a storyteller until I talked to Scott. And so I thought, you know, that'd be great to spend a day with him driving around the roads of Belgium and fleshing out these stories that he has about these races and what are the things he's trying to tell with the different races. So I thought it was really, really insightful. And I think anybody who loves the classics will find this feature to be really interesting.
That's the thing. A bike race, you can take it just as a pure sporting competition where you have a bunch of guys racing and a winner at the end, and that's it, and that's fine. For me, cycling is textured and multi-layered, and teasing out these stories is really interesting. From things like Gent-Wevelgem, which commemorates the soldiers who fell in the Great War, it was really interesting to hear Scott talk about the different stories, narratives, meanings and culture of each race. And it was him who came up with the comparison that the Tour of Flanders is like Stairway to Heaven, because it seems that Scott Sunderland in his misspent youth was an aspirant musician.
Yeah, he did a lot. He went to a lot of gigs, I think, and maybe even helped out some bands and stuff. But yeah, he loves music. I talked to him a lot about music since I also play. Scott's interested in a lot of things in life, and so and it shows, I think, in his, you know, the way he thinks about a bike race, as you said, all the different layers. And any day I can go drive around back roads of Flanders, especially with somebody, you know, as knowledgeable as Scott, it's a pretty great day for me.
We've managed to find space for a photo feature in the new edition of Ruler, James, and this one needed it, and it's quite topical. It's entitled A Weekend in Provence. It's your adventures at the very, very rainy and wet and windy Tour de la Provence, and the winner was Mads Pedersen. Tell us about the experience of covering that race.
Well, I think you should call it more my misadventures, because it was just, the weather was, you know, it's a 4-day race, and we had a great opening TT in Marseille, and then 2 days in just horrible conditions, you know, driving wind, freezing rain. My cameras just recovered. I just only got them out of the shop, and they just took in so much water. It was miserable, but also in its own ways, very photogenic. And I've covered this race for 5 years, I guess, and it was canceled last year to management problems. So I was really excited when it came back. And it's a lovely race. I mean, bike racing, Provence, what's not to like about it, except the weather. And then, as you said, even in bad weather, Provence still has its own sort of visual poetry, I would say. Like with the opening shot that I have of the old lavender fields, you know, and they're not lavender, they're not colored, they're not purple like lavender usually is, because they're still, you know, in the middle of the winter, but they still have such graphic lines that provide a photographer with visual possibilities and they're just there all along the roadside there. So it was tremendous. And then as far as the racing went, well, geez, yeah, I mean, Mads Pedersen won 3 out of 4 stages. And I could tell then that he's going to be a player in this year's Classics. And I think he's pretty much on par with, Vanderpool or Van Aert, even though he often gets considered just under them.
Yep, and reminded me way too much of spring in the UK as far as the weather went. The next feature is called Dancing on the Pedals. Just loved this feature, purely because of not just because of the incredible photography. So to put it into context, the R&B artist DJ Spoonie, turns out he's quite a cycling enthusiast, and he's an ambassador for Ribble Cycles, and so we arranged to go and take some photographs of his bike and even more impressively his record collection, which takes up an entire page of the magazine. And Rachel Jarry went to interview him as well, just about what his relationship is with the sport. But are you an R&B fan, DJ Spoonie fan, James?
I have to say I'm more of a rhythm and blues fan, but I'm not a connoisseur, I have to admit.
Yeah, I mean, I made sure when I was doing the editing for this, because I don't know much about DJ Spoonie, it's fallen between the gaps of my musical knowledge, I made sure I listened to some of his tracks when I was doing the editing on the piece, so I could kind of understand him more. But come for the incredible photographs by Sean Hardy of DJ Spoonie's bike and his record collection, and stay for the fascinating story about a very interesting character. Also in the magazine, we've got a fascinating interview with Gus Morton, about his latest film, which is called Crit Dreams. And that film tells the story of the American Criterium Cup season and the American cycling team. Just fascinating story about, you know, the crit scene in America, which kind of goes around these Midwestern small cities, large towns, and is a quite alien world from maybe the rest of the cycling world, but has its own energy, meaning, and culture, and found that piece absolutely fascinating. And the next feature in the magazine, entitled Smooth Operator, is an interview by Andy McGrath, former editor of Ruler, with David Lapartien, the president of the UCI. And earlier on in the week, I caught up with Andy and asked him what his impressions were of David Lapartien when he did that. I'm joined on Ruler Conversations by former Ruler editor Andy McGrath. I should say welcome back, Andy. We miss you very much.
Good to be back, yeah. How's everyone doing?
Everyone's doing fine, except that your presence is missed in the office. So, for Ruler 126, Andy, you interviewed the UCI president, David Lapartien, and the feature is entitled Smooth Operator. That is him, not you. And before we talk about the feature, we should talk about what we were trying to do here. And when you pitched me this feature, we did discuss a bit what we were going to get out of it, because Lapartien is, in my opinion, you may have a different opinion, a very tough interviewee. Very polite, very well presented. He can be opinionated. Don't think he's bland, but there's a sense that he's exceptionally pragmatic and it's very hard to get beneath the surface. And we wondered, didn't we, even before the interview happened, whether it would be worth it or not.
Yeah, I remember that call. Me, the consummate professional, was actually having a pint of Guinness in the Heathrow terminal Wetherspoons before flying out to the UAE, where the interview was meant to happen in its entirety, but it didn't for various reasons. And yeah, we talked about watch him, you know, really watch him, what he's doing, observe tiny mannerisms. There's small things, there's big things. Like I kind of noticed he always wears a blue tie, pretty much. You know, what does that mean? What's that coat pin on his blazer that he always wears? But anyway, so this interview was the culmination of a three-day press trip with the esports platform My Whoosh. And he had flown in, so had Tadej Pogačar, to be there for the press conference, for the announcement, basically. But there was a ride around this 10K desert circuit where I was just watching him, really. Got my photo of me on Tadej's wheel. But then I was just watching the party and, you know, trying to listen in to him speaking to Mauro Gianetti and then having a little chat with him, just, you know, sidling up to him. He's a decent rider, you know, just... He says he does 4,000 to 5,000 kilometers a year, which I find hard to believe based on the amount of jobs he has and his apparent work rate. He does seem to work quite hard. But yeah, it was just quite funny that they'd given him a mountain biker's helmet, basically. That's what I would take it like to be. And everyone else was in road getup. And he was riding with Pogačar for 10, 15, 20 minutes. So I don't know what they were chatting about, but he seems to kind of glom on to high-profile figures, which is what politicians do. He's very good at that. We've seen it, you know, in the past, and we'll see it in the future. And there was, you know, there was this press conference. I was just watching him. He was talking over the speaker, off mic sometimes, which I personally think is a little bit rude, but, you know, that's fine. And but when it was his turn to speak, he just switched it on. There's not even a mask. That's him, and he's a consummate pro. He didn't really need notes. And there was a... So each journalist on this press trip had... 5-minute slots, which is suboptimal, to put it extremely politely. And I've been promised much more, and it ended up being 15 minutes. But anyway, he had a UCI press manager there, a comms manager, but he didn't need him, was my feeling, you know. The comms manager barked at a few journalists, you know, only questions about My Whoosh or something else, which I had no intention of doing, frankly. He can handle it. And he was getting some vaguely tough questions because journalists were only being given 5 minutes. You have to, you know, lead with the heavy artillery. So I wasn't sure how long I would have, but anyway, ended up having a much longer video chat with him from his office in Egle in Switzerland weeks later, which gave me pretty much all the feature. You told me I wouldn't get much, but secretly I always hope I'll get something. You know, you don't expect a big headline, but a little admission or a slip. And there wasn't really one, you know. He's slick. He's a smooth operator.
Yeah, he's very polished. I mean, he's obviously a very smart guy. He's very good at working people, and he's very ambitious. You also went into the feature, though. It's like, it's easy to for us to consider him as the UCI president, but he's got a background and a context as well. I thought it was quite interesting when you talked about his upbringing and in Breton cycling culture, because we see him as this kind of international political operator, but his context originally was Breton cycling. You don't get anything more localized in cycling than that, do you? It's a real independent scene that has its own character and meaning.
He very much belongs to that scene. You know, he was the race organizer for the Grand Prix Plumilic. So in some ways he is hyperlocal, or that's where he started, was on that patch. And it's not fair to say that he's outgrown it. I'm not sure if he's mayor of Sarzeau anymore. I think that might have ended. But for a long time, he was juggling local politics with running international cycling, which is I say in the article, when the COVID pandemic first struck, he was dealing with serious local issues. And in the morning, and then in the afternoon, he'd be trying to reshape the calendar and, you know, work out where can Paris-Roubaix fit and how short should the Vuelta be and so and so. Yeah, so it's... there were some things that didn't go in the article too. I mean, he has kids and he mentioned they're not into cycling, they're into equestrianism. So that's where most of his UCI salary probably goes, you know, upkeep for the horses. We talked about doping. I think that didn't make it in there because he didn't give enough of a quote, really. We talked about safety too. And he frankly routed on for 5 minutes talking about foundations and organisations. That's the other thing. He just talks like... He's a long answerer. But half the time, he's not saying anything of substance. So after 5 minutes, I was kind of basically said, yes, but what does that actually mean tangibly? What are the safety changes that will happen, you know, partly in the light of, you know, Maeda's tragic death? Because it is important to know what's changed, you know. It means better signs, more signalers, strict specifications, training sessions for drivers in races, education about rider safety. He said there's not a single point to change, it's lots of points, you know. That wasn't strong enough to go in the feature, ultimately.
Yeah, and it's kind of, what he's very good at doing is, yeah, talking at length, stating the obvious, really, isn't he? Talking very broad brushstrokes, and that's what he's good at. I mean, the only point in the interview I felt where you may have got a bit more out of him is when you asked him about the UCI's relationship with, you know, the UAE or having the world there and what that means for the LGBTQIA+ community. And I felt his answers there a little bit less satisfying than the other, a bit less convincing than the other answers, because you had put him on the spot with a very difficult subject that demands an answer.
Yeah, like it's going to sound like an excuse, but that was my interview in the UAE was wrapped up after 15 minutes. I was basically told final question, and I've been waiting to drop that one. So I think I kind of followed up once, but that was as much as I could do, and then it was interview over, you know. And that's the thing. He doesn't want to engage really in problematic human rights. I'm personally quite tired of the line that sport and politics doesn't mix, because we know that a sport like cycling, especially, it does mix all the time. You know, it's crossing borders. You need, you know, governments to okay grand departs, let alone ones in, say, Israel or Denmark or Yorkshire, you know, foreign countries. And they're complicit. My feeling is he can't keep avoiding this question about human rights or not being firmer. The UCI have not signed up to, I think it's a UN charter for business and human rights, something like that. FIFA and the IOC have. Not sure what that changes, seeing that the World Cup in 10 years' time will likely go to Saudi Arabia, which is not famed for having excellent human rights. I think there's more the UCI could do there for sure. And we see this battery of World Championships going to the UAE in 4 or 5 years' time. And I think the time to put pressure on them, if anyone wants to, is pre-selection or around the time of selection of the champs. You can't do it 6 months before October 2028 when it's being held in the UAE, you know. For sporting levels, I can see it is right to take it around the world. It is right to offer different things. But I just sometimes wish there'd be less bottom covering from politicians, you know. Just acknowledge some of the issues like a normal human being, because they're there, they're out there, they're not going away. But you aren't going to get that from a skilled, high-level politician.
He kind of just skated over it by saying, you know, the UCI is politically neutral. But I just think that's a bit of a cop-out on this occasion, just for, you know, the reasons you just said. It is an important thing. And you mentioned the IOC just now as well, and you pressed him at the very end of the interview, which I thought was very, in a very amusing exchange between you. You pressed him about whether he would like to be IOC president one day. And with the elections coming up next year, I think, it's a pertinent question. So what was your impression of that?
I felt like the answer that he gave was fairly non-committal, but he said enough to kind of imply that he's not interested in it, that maybe even that he'll have to wait a few years. His answer was along the lines of Thomas Vatt, the incumbent president, might be given another term under a special exemption. So he might have to see, basically. And I did say, you haven't really answered my question. And he laughed and he said, no, but you weren't expecting me to, which sums him up. Sums up the whole kind of, you know, artificial interview dynamic between the journalist and the politician.
It's quite knowing for him to say, I haven't answered your question, but you were not expecting me to. It's kind of the TLDR of this whole feature. Last question, Andy, maybe more of a subjective one for you. Do you think he's a good UCI president?
That's a good question. I think he's a modern UCI president, and we've had some older school ones in the past. I think he does acknowledge the need for the business model to change, and he's in the middle trying to make that work with ASO holding the best cards. I think he's been decent. He's been decent. He's been a steady pair of hands, but it just feels so dirty to say that he's been a good UCI president. He steadied the ship, really. There's still a lot to do. Still a lot to change.
So, Andy's feature, Smooth Operator, is a really enjoyable read. I think it's really put Lapartien and his career into its full context. And thank you very much, Andy, for popping back into Ruler Towers.
Great to be here. Thanks, Ed.
So that was Andy McGrath, former editor of Ruler. We miss him very much. And just to discuss a few of the last features of the magazine, Herbie Sykes sent us in an incredible story about Maria Cressari, who was an Italian cyclist in the 1960s and 70s, who, despite the complete lack of interest by the Italian Cycling Federation in women's cycling at that time, managed to build a career and set a world hour record in Mexico soon after Eddie Merckx set his famous hour record. Herbie always does an incredible job of, you know, picking up the stories and meaning in Italian cycling, and this piece, I learned so much from it. I really recommend readers get their teeth into this story. It's a fascinating, unique history of women's cycling in Italy at a very specific time. And we've also got our regular art cycle feature. Bit of a departure this time, James. Normally we look at the old masters, the modern artists, famous artists. Didn't quite go with that angle this time. Tell us about art cycle in Ruler 126.
The thing I like about Art Cycle is that we get a lot of feedback from it, and people write in and say, oh, you know, I like that last feature. By the way, do you know this artist? Or have you thought about covering this piece? And you know, I put them into my list. I got a list now that just continues to build. But we got this mail sometime in, like, last year saying, you know, if you're, you know, looking for new subjects for the Art Cycle, consider Andreas Klier, the ex-German professional who's now a DS at EF. He started painting like a year or two ago, and he's now represented by a major gallery in Palma de Mallorca and selling a lot of paintings. This is a very high-profile gallery, and he had his first one-man show last year in the spring and sold over half the paintings right out. And these are painters that are going for like serious cashola, like 10 grand and stuff. I mean, that's serious. The gallery owner works with very big artists, but his name is Garrett Brown. And he just really liked the paintings that Clear was producing. They said, I don't have anything like this in my gallery, and it's interesting, and I think there's a market for it. And he put them right. So I was down in Spain, and, you know, in the early season, I did the Roglic interview in Mallorca. That was in the previous issue, and then I went over to Alicante for Woot. And so I called up Andreas. I said, you know, I'm going to be here. Are you around? He said, sure. So we spent a morning at the gallery. And the gallery is like, I mean, it's in the heart of the old town. And the gallery is like at least 5 major gallery spaces. The Garrett Brown Gallery itself is like most of a street in Palma, Mallorca. And again, big name artist. And so I got a little bit of the backstory about how he started painting. And he said, I've never really painted before. I didn't know much about it. And then I was in Boston for some meetings with EF, and I ended up going into the Boston Art Museum, and I stumbled across a room of paintings of Max Beckmann and was just blown away. And he started painting as a result of that. And although, you know, there's certain nods to expressionism and stuff like Beckmann, he's created his own style very quickly, and I think his sense of color is outstanding. He has a sense of color tone that's unique and outstanding, and as well as his sense of lines. I instantly was attracted to the paintings. I thought they were really, really high quality. And then, you know, this former professional bike racer, I mean, pretty good bike racer too, right? You know, I'd met him in Flanders because he used to live there. I mean, he was considered like the most Flemish of the Germans, that's for sure. He used to live there. And I was on a training ride once with Peter van Petegem, and all of a sudden, Clear is there because they were training partners and they just would run into each other and ride together. And so I just thought there was a whole lot of elements there that made this an interesting feature for the classics issue.
Yeah, I was quite interested in the different aspects of his personality which come through, because he's quite straight as a rider and as a DS. And when I've talked to him in the past, he's very informative, very clear, you know, name by nature, and kind of exact and a little bit introverted as well, maybe. And that's his words, not mine. At the same time, exuberant and expressionist. I mean, you can't really be expressionistic as a DS, can you? But it's obviously picking up on some aspect of his character which bike racing does not fulfill.
Absolutely. And he says that quite often. You know, he said it's actually the painting goes kind of hand in hand, because he's often reacting to constantly. Said there's a real push and pull between his career as a sports director and as a painter, and he says they really actually go hand in hand. I couldn't see painting just painting, and this gives me a wonderful release, I guess, when I've been directing and focusing on all these little minute details that are part of his job.
Let's hope he doesn't get the two mixed up in the team car anytime soon. So that's Andreas Clear. Also in the magazine, we've got a feature about Rattle Gravel, which is Valtteri Bottas and Tiffany Cromwell's new event in Australia. And Rachel Jarry went and rode Rattle Gravel at the start of the year in the Australian summer. We've got Explore feature at Valta 2000, which is one of the venues of Tadej Pogacar's domination in the Volta a Catalunya recently. There are features on Pirelli, SmartFit, Obi, our usual columns by Ned Bolting and Orla Chenoui, which always add a huge amount to the magazine, and many, many more articles and features. So that's Ruler 126, the Classics edition. Please subscribe by going to ruler.cc/subscribe. And you can enter the code PODCAST15 to get 15% off the advertised price. That is all for Rulo Conversation this week. James, final word from you. Who is going to win the Tour of Flanders?
Pedersen.
Thank you very much indeed. See you next week. You have been listening to Rulo Conversations. Rulo Conversations is made by the editorial staff of Rulo Magazine. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Rulo and on Instagram at Rulo Magazine, or visit our website at rulo.cc. This edition of Rulo Conversations was produced by Joseph Perry of Content is Queen.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.